Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
As you may know, I love to shop for jackets and boots this season. And when I do, I always make sure I get cash back from Rakuten. And it's not just clothing and shoes. You can get cash back from over 750 stores on electronics, travel, home decor, and more. It's super easy, and before I buy anything, I always go to Rakuten first. Join for free at Rakuten.ca, start shopping, and get your cash back sent to you by check or PayPal. Refer a friend and get cha-ching for every friend you bring. $30 for you, $30 for them. Get the Rakuten app or join at Rakuten.ca. Rakuten.ca.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and on Monday, the 10th of April, these are our main stories. Belarusian ruler Alexander Lukashenko says Russia must protect his country if it's attacked. Two prominent Chinese activists have been handed lengthy prison sentences after campaigning for greater government transparency. Twitter's owner Elon Musk says he's seeking clarification on the funding of the BBC after the corporation objected to the social media site, labelling it as state-supported. Also in this podcast, the spiritual leader of Buddhists, the Dalai Lama, apologises over a viral video showing him asking a young boy this.
And suck my tongue.
One of President Putin's staunchest allies is the president of Belarus, Alexander Lukashenko, who's been in power since 1994. In February last year, he allowed Russian forces to stage part of the invasion of Ukraine from Belarusian territory. Now he's asked Moscow for security guarantees.
In case there is an attack on Belarus, the Russian Federation defends Belarus like its own territory. That's the kind of guarantee we need. Actually, in the 1990s, it was more or less discussed. Now, because of what the West has been doing, this has been forgotten. What safety guarantees can America provide us with? None. Apart from provoking aggression towards us, we need full security guarantees from our brothers in Russia.
Mr. Lukashenko was speaking after talks in Minsk with Russia's Defence Minister Sergei Shoigu. I asked the defence and diplomatic analyst Jonathan Marcus if this underlined the difficult position Mr. Lukashenko is in.
There are three stories, if you like, mixed together here. One, of course, is the fate of Belarus itself and its leader, an authoritarian state facing some opposition at home. There's the relationship between Belarus and Russia. Russia, of course, insistent that it wants to anchor as many countries into its system as possible. And Belarus is, if you like, top of the list there. And then, of course, there's clearly the implications of that relationship for the war in Ukraine. So I think what many people will be looking at and asking is, does this move lead to any greater likelihood of Belarus taking an active role in the war? That's very hard to say at the moment, but it is part and parcel of an ever closer relationship between Belarus and Moscow.
And last month, Vladimir Putin announced plans to station tactical nuclear weapons on Belarusian soil.
He did, with a very rapid timetable. He said he hoped that these weapons would be in place by the summer. It looks as though these would be air-delivered bombs, and we're told that Belarus pilots will be trained to operate the aircraft to deliver these weapons. I think many analysts believe that was a fairly optimistic timetable. People have been scouring satellite photos of Belarus air bases and have not really seen any preparations for the kind of facilities that would be needed to house nuclear weapons. Of course, this is all part and parcel of the wider nuclear saber-rattling by President Putin, who has clearly resorted to threats about nuclear weapons on multiple occasions ever since he put his troops across the border into Ukraine.
Many people have thought that Belarus, as such a key ally of Russia, was already under its security umbrella. Why does he feel the need to publicly make this call?
Well, that's interesting. And whether it is insecurities of his own regime, whether it is an attempt to offer things to Mr. Putin to be able to stave off you know, pressure to actually become actively involved in the war is very hard to say. I mean, a lot of this is very opaque, what's been going on behind the scenes. Mr. Shoigu has been in Belarus a number of times in recent months. So the pace of discussions about all of this have clearly been increasing. I mean, we have to remember that Belarus allowed its territory to be used for some of the initial invasion of Ukraine by Russian forces. It's provided instructors to the Russian military. It's allowed its training bases to be used for training Russian troops. And of course, it's been exercising and mobilizing significant parts of its own armed forces over the past several months. Though, of course, so far has actually not taken that dramatic step of actually becoming actively engaged as a participant in the war itself.
Jonathan Marcus. Tensions are growing in Ethiopia as massive anti-government protests continue in the northern Amhara region. The demonstrations were triggered after the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed's office announced plans on Thursday to disband the Amhara Special Forces, or ASF. They've promised to oppose the order. Special forces and militias from Amhara fought in support of the Federal Army during its two-year war in the neighbouring Tigray region. I spoke to Kalkadan Yibultel in Addis Ababa.
So far, we've seen protest rallies and blocking of roads using burning tyres or rocks, and also staying at home strikes in several places, and it's pretty comprehensive. Now, to give you some context, this is the region, the second largest region in Ethiopia, and it's neighboring with the northernmost region, Tigray, and because of that, it was highly involved in the civil war between 2020 and last year. Now, these latest protests are triggered by an order announced by the federal government to dissolve a paramilitary force in the region. It's called the Amhara Special Forces, and these forces have been involved in the fighting in the war. Now, the government says that they want to integrate these forces either into the army or the police to have a unified force. But people in the region see it as premature. They also say that dissolving this force could expose the region to attacks from either Tigray or another neighboring region.
And armed clashes have been reported.
Yes, in some areas, armed clashes have been reported between members of the army and the ASF. Now, these forces have been allies for 2 years until a few months ago. But as soon as these protests came, there have been restrictions on the internet in the region. So it's been difficult to confirm whether these clashes happened and to what extent they have happened. But residents said that they have heard heavy artillery being fired, and they also said that there were indeed clashes.
So is the government going to listen to these protests?
Well, so far we haven't seen any signs of that. On Sunday, the Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed, gave a pretty strong statement. He said that the plan to dissolve these forces will continue even if there are prices to be paid. Now, one thing that we must remember is when the war in Tigray began in late 2020, initially the government said that they were on a law enforcement mission against some forces there. So there are these pretty strong concerns in the country that the country could be, you know, jumping from one crisis into another.
Kalkadan Yibultel in Addis Ababa. China says its military drills around Taiwan have ended successfully. The display of force is Beijing's angry response to a visit by the Taiwanese president to the US. The manoeuvres, dubbed Operation Joint Sword, are practicing mock precision strikes on targets in the self-governing island. Shaima Khalil is following events from Tokyo.
China said it was simulating sealing off Taiwan, with its aircraft carrier Shandong playing a significant role in the third day of exercises. Chinese officials said fighter planes loaded with live ammunition had carried out multiple waves of simulated strikes on important targets. Taiwan's defense ministry said more than 30 Chinese aircraft entered its air defense space, and that four of those were J-15 fighter jets. The Chinese army published a short video of the simulated attacks on Taiwan, with missiles fired from land, sea and air into the island's territory, two of them exploding as they hit their targets. Taiwan considers itself a sovereign state, while China sees it as a breakaway province that will eventually be brought under Beijing's control, by force if necessary. It views any support of Taiwan as interference in its internal affairs.
Shaima Khalil. There was a time when Xu Zhuyong and Ding Xiaoxi were seen as the next big thing in China. Not now. The two men, prominent human rights activists, have just been given lengthy prison sentences for attending private gatherings. They've already spent 3 years in detention. They co-founded the New Citizens Movement to campaign for civil rights and government transparency. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more about them.
Well, Su Zhiyong is a very well-known legal scholar. He's very well-respected in legal circles in China, and he developed a whole career for himself. He became increasingly outspoken throughout his career. And alongside Ding Jiaxi, who's also an outspoken activist, they founded something called the New Citizens Movement, where they used social media, they talked to the press, they tried to get people really involved in the idea that China has a constitution and it outlines civil rights in the constitution. And all China really needs to do is stick to its own constitution. And so in real terms, that meant that they thought that all children in China should have equal access to education. Back when Xu and Ding were really getting a lot of attention, millions of Chinese children whose parents traveled to go and work in factories and cities were not allowed to follow their parents and attend school in the same city as their parents. They had to be left behind in the countryside because that's the only place where they were allowed to attend school. Those men thought that was wrong, and they were trying to campaign against that. Crucially, they were also campaigning for Chinese officials to have to disclose their wealth.
And their convictions have been described as cruelly farcical.
Yeah, I don't think that their sentences have come as any great surprise. A few years ago, around 2013, 2014, there was a huge crackdown on the legal profession in China. I think it should be noted that they're also being quite cruelly treated inside prison. It's not just a prison sentence. It's a prison sentence under extremely cruel conditions for two men who really were seen as China's future at one point, very thoughtful, well-educated men who really were campaigning peacefully for change in China, for all people in China to be treated equally.
Celia Hatton. Three words uttered by the Dalai Lama have been causing controversy. Suck my tongue. In a video at a public event, the Tibetan spiritual leader kissed a young boy on the lips before placing a hand on the child's shoulder and sticking his tongue out.
And suck my tongue.
The Dalai Lama has today apologised. I spoke to our correspondent Raghvendra Rao in Delhi.
In the video, you know, you see the Dalai Lama asking the boy to kiss him on his cheek. He motions to his cheek and says, first here. And the boy then, you know, kisses him on the cheek and gives him a hug. The Dalai Lama then is seen holding the boy's hand, and he then motions to his lips and says, I think here also. And then the Dalai Lama kisses the boy on the lips. And then he puts his forehead to that of the boy's before sticking out his tongue, saying, and suck my tongue. The boy sticks his tongue out, but he withdraws eventually, and so does the Dalai Lama. And after that, there are more hugs between the boy and the spiritual leader. So that is essentially what all can be seen in this video.
And the boy looks pretty uncomfortable, doesn't he?
Yeah, sure he does. I mean, he seems to be very, you know, caught very off guard when the Dalai Lama asks him to suck his tongue. His discomfort is very, very apparent.
What has the Dalai Lama's office said about this?
So the Dalai Lama's office has issued a statement. They've said that the Dalai Lama wishes to apologize to the boy and his family. It's basically for the hurt his words may have caused. The statement also goes on to say that the Dalai Lama often teases people he meets in an innocent and playful way, and this happens at times in public and even before cameras. But having said that, the statement says clearly that the Tibetan spiritual leader regrets this incident.
Yeah, he says innocent and playful, but there's been quite a sceptical reaction from around the world, hasn't there?
Absolutely. I mean, the barrage of criticism we've seen on the social media is reflective of the manner in which people have responded to this video. And in fact, many are calling this very, very inappropriate behavior. The criticism has been there and it's been mounting.
Raghavendra Rao in Delhi. Still to come in this podcast.
Come on, let's go, kid. Baby girl, come on.
Did you ever take your neighbour's dog for a walk? How much did that get you? We look at how to make dog walking really pay. But first, it's been 25 years since Penn scratched paper on the 1998 Good Friday Agreement, which set up self-government in Northern Ireland based on power sharing between Protestant Unionists and Catholic Republicans. The agreement ended decades of violent conflict in Northern Ireland. But 25 years on, those same institutions have been paralysed in protest against post-Brexit trading arrangements, as Charlotte Gallagher told me from Belfast.
This really all came about, Alex, because of Brexit and the post-trading arrangements that came into place when the UK left the EU. And the Democratic Unionist Party, the largest unionist party here, essentially feel that they're being cut off from the rest of the UK. They feel very strongly that they are British, they want to remain in the United Kingdom. And for them, those Brexit trading arrangements just weren't good enough. So they have essentially boycotted going back into power sharing in the devolved government here until their concerns are addressed and dealt with. And at the moment, despite various negotiations and deals between the UK and the EU, it doesn't seem like the DUP are in any mood to return to Stormont. So what we've got essentially is a political standoff here, the building itself where politicians should be debating and sorting out things that are going on in Northern Ireland. Is essentially mothballed, really, Alex. Nothing is happening. And you speak to people here and they're really fed up with the situation. And 25 years on from the Good Friday Agreement, that historic agreement that ended, largely ended, the violence that had marred people's lives here for decades, they're still not going back to Stormont. And I think had they've been at Stormont, there's no doubt that Joe Biden, the US president, on his visit here this week would have addressed politicians in Stormont, but he's actually not going there now. He's just going to be spending a morning and an afternoon in Belfast, but he's not going to be addressing Northern Irish politicians.
So does that mean that Joe Biden's visit is going to change anything?
I think it's hard to say, isn't it? I think the Democratic Unionist Party, they are very fixed in their position. They have said they will not go back until the deal is done that they are happy with. It's their red line, essentially. So for them, I think Joe Biden visiting really isn't going to change things. It could perhaps focus minds that had he come at a different time and addressed politicians at Stormont, it would have had a very different feel, this visit. But I think for the DUP, they feel so strongly about those Brexit trading arrangements, I doubt it will change anything for them.
Charlotte Gallagher. More details about the coronation of King Charles are trickling out, with just a few weeks to go before he's crowned. Buckingham Palace has shared the processional routes the King and Queen Camilla will take on May the 6th, as well as the regalia to be used during the service. Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell reports.
It will be on a more modest scale than the coronation of the late Queen Elizabeth, with far fewer guests in Westminster Abbey and a procession back to Buckingham Palace which will only cover about a quarter of the distance compared to 1953. But many of the traditional elements will be the same. The crown jewels, the regalia, symbols of the monarch's authority, the sovereign's orb and sceptres, the swords, bracelets and spurs, all will have a part in this elaborate religious service before Charles is crowned with St Edward's crown. Camilla will be crowned with Queen Mary's crown, which is being set with some of the Cullinan diamonds, and she will hold the Queen Consort's ivory rod. And just as it was in 1953, the journey back to the palace will be made in the 18th century gold state coach. One modern touch, the palace has launched a special coronation emoji, a crown.
Nicholas Witchell. It's a question that has puzzled scientists for decades. Why are some species more affected by cancers than others? Cancer is caused by mutations in cells within our genes, so it would suggest that larger animals who have a greater number of cells would be more affected by cancers. But this is not so. So, what causes the variation? Scientists at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge are about to receive their first sample of the oldest known living vertebrate, a Greenland shark, which is thought to have a lifespan of between 300 and 500 years. It's hoped this may help unlock the answer to the conundrum. Alex Kagan is a scientist at the Wellcome Sanger Institute in Cambridge, which has been leading the research.
Across the tree of life in different animal species, what we've observed is there's enormous variation in the cancer risk of different species. So some animals, like the naked mole rat, seem to live their whole lives almost never getting cancer. And some of these large live species, like whales, are also able to live much longer lifespans than we can with very low rates of cancer. Whereas other species, like dogs and cats, have very high rates of cancer. It's one of the leading causes of mortality in those animals. So there's a huge amount of variation across the tree of life in cancer risk.
And do we have a theory, a standing theory, as to what the difference is between dogs and cats, say, the domestic pets, and some of the other species that you've just mentioned?
Well, yeah, there's a lot of different theories, but what we're really lacking is the data to test them. So this idea is that potentially some of these larger, longer-lived animals might have better ways of protecting their DNA from damage, which could reduce their cancer risk. Or there's other ideas that they may be just, you know, living in environments where they're less exposed to the causes of cancer.
What are you going to learn from the Greenland shark, do you think?
So at the Sanger Institute, we're a genetics institute. And so what we've been doing over the last couple of years is looking at the DNA very carefully in animals with different body sizes and lifespans to really see, do they have better mechanisms of DNA repair? And when we've done that, partnering with London Zoo in mammals of different lifespans, we have indeed found that longer-lived species seem to be much better at protecting their DNA from damage. And this could be one of the ways that they're reducing their cancer risk. But we've never had a chance to look at such a long-lived species as the Greenland shark, which is really incredible. I mean, living 300 to 500 years. It's this extraordinary lifespan. So we're really curious to see, does this species have, you know, much better ways of protecting its DNA than we do? And what can we learn from that?
Obviously, the knowledge and understanding is of enormous value in itself. But can you instantly see what use it could be put to in terms of helping with cancer in animals or in humans, for that matter?
Yeah, that's the kind of ultimate question. So it's unclear at the moment, but we're really excited because when we look at nature, what it suggests is that some of these species must have evolved superior mechanisms to reduce their risk of cancer. And by studying them, what we're hoping is that we can learn what these mechanisms are. And once we know what they are, then we can start to think about, are there ways that we could apply this to our own species?
And, I mean, these sort of answers are probably decades away, I imagine, anyway. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, yeah, I guess we won't know until we understand what these mechanisms are. I certainly wouldn't think it's something that would happen in the short term. But in the long term, I think it's a very promising avenue of research to try and understand, you know, what are these secrets? What are the ways that these species have avoided cancer? And, you know, they're animals like us. They have cells that are similar to us. So I think there is hope that by understanding those mechanisms, we could one day think of ways of potentially applying them to protect other animals and to protect ourselves from cancer.
Scientist Alex Kagan. The boss of Twitter, Elon Musk, has responded to BBC objections to being labelled as government-funded media on one of its main Twitter accounts. Mr. Musk said his platform was aiming for maximum transparency and accuracy. Earlier, the BBC explained that it was independent and funded by the British people through the licence fee. Our technology correspondent, James Clayton, has been in direct contact with Mr. Musk over the issue.
When I saw that Twitter had added this label, I decided just to email Elon Musk. I'm a technology reporter. Sometimes we do reach out to Twitter. And I just thought I would email Elon Musk and just say to him, look, this is actually how the BBC is funded. It's funded through the license fee. It's paid for by the British public. And he responded. He responded, first of all, just saying, oh, do you think this label is inaccurate? And then he came up with a suggestion himself. He said maybe the accounts themselves should link to the sourcing of funding. I then pushed him on that and he gave me a much sort of longer email. He said, we are aiming for maximum transparency and accuracy. Linking to ownership and source of funds probably makes sense. I do think media organizations should be self-aware and not falsely claim the complete absence of bias. All organizations have bias, some obviously much more than others. I should note that I follow BBC News on Twitter because I think it is among the least biased. Now, I think what you get an impression of there is that this is policy that is not defined yet. This is most certainly spitballing. It is policy on the hoof. He is thinking, he is being inquisitive about what to do with accounts like the BBC's. The problem is the label has already been attached to the BBC's, one of the BBC's Twitter accounts. And you've seen this with other media organisations as well. So you have NPR, National Public Radio. A few days ago, that was labelled as state-affiliated media, akin to Russia Today. Now, that has now been taken down because that simply isn't true. But what you're seeing is, once again, Elon Musk sort of riffing, making policy up as he goes along. Now, sometimes that can be really effective in business. But what I would add to that is the problem we have in this case is the media organizations are being labeled. They're then being unlabeled or they're being labeled as something else. And it all feels a little bit chaotic, frankly. And you've got organizations like NPR and BBC, who absolutely strenuously believe in impartiality and accuracy, being labelled in ways that they simply don't trust or believe in or believe is accurate. So that's it in a nutshell. But Elon Musk, you know, he clearly seems to like the BBC. He trusts the BBC. But, you know, you do have very clearly this sort of slightly strange situation with Elon Musk that you can kind of email him and he will simply email you back a response.
James Clayton speaking to Lucy Gray. And full disclosure here, although the vast bulk of BBC funding comes from members of the British public paying an annual licence fee, we do get some income from advertising and other commercial deals, and some government funding supports some of our foreign language work. Have you ever wondered how dog walkers make ends meet? Well, in New York, the average walker makes under $50,000 a year. But a growing number have found a way to make it pay over $100,000. The BBC's Michelle Fleury went to meet some of them.
My pup, Willie, is what led us there. He's the pup who started it all.
Michael Josephs is the owner of Parkside Pups, a dog walking service.
It was a side hustle that naturally started to pick up more, and I was having so much fun with it and meeting the people and helping out the pups.
Today, he makes more money walking dogs than he did as a special needs teacher in downtown Manhattan.
They're probably going right into the water.
Annually, we're over six figures this year. Over the last 2 years, we've grown 250%.
And there's no shortage of customers. Part of that has to do with all those pandemic puppies. Michael says with work from home winding down, more pet owners are calling him.
I have so many puppies that I've picked up in the last year, which has really helped the company grow.
Demand for dog walkers has skyrocketed. This year alone, the dog walking business in America is expected to grow 3%. And it's already worth an estimated $1 billion.
Come on, let's go, kid.
But could a cooling economy change that?
I think we are recession-proof.
Nick Rodriguez was a New York City doorman before starting Doors and Dogs almost 10 years ago.
Baby girl, come on.
We service and operate in the most affluent neighborhoods in New York. These are typically the people who get the bailouts or people who work in the industries that are rarely affected by economic turmoil.
Despite the recent banking turmoil and higher interest rates, he's confident that poop pays.
You love your dog like your child. So because you love your dog like your child, because you may be inclined to even work more, we're still a necessity in these animals' lives.
For these two, dog walking isn't just a walk in the park. It's a lucrative business, even if the clientele can sometimes be a handful.
Michelle Fleury in New York. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @GlobalNewsPod. This edition was mixed by Volodymyr Muzechka, and the producer was Terry Egan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.